Hello, Hub listeners. Welcome to the Weekly Roundtable. I'm Rudyard Griffiths, publisher of The Hub. I'm joined by Sean Spear, our editor-at-large. Sean, how do we find you? What is it, 4 days after the federal budget? We're recording today on the 19th of April. Have you reached your, like, peak capacity for macro political economy analysis? How do we find you this Friday?
Yeah, today, Rudyard, you find me in transition mode, transitioning out of a federal budget mindset into an NHL playoff mindset. The Toronto Maple Leafs start their quest for a Stanley Cup tomorrow. And so I'll be pushing all out of all those budget numbers out of my head overnight and starting to fill it with hockey statistics as we enter the playoff season. How about you?
Yeah, looking forward to that game. It's the Boston Bruins, right? Like, they're, what's the expression? I'm like a Johnny come lately to the Leafs. I love them when they're in the playoffs after conspicuously ignoring them for most of the year. So I hear, Sean, if I'm right, the Bruins are a tough team. This is not going to be an easy first round.
It's not. And of course, the Leafs only made it to the first round last year for the first time, you know, in more than a decade. And it's been since the mid-60s since they won the Stanley Cup. So I say, only partly facetiously, if this is the year, if this is finally the year they do it, I'm bringing my young boys to Toronto for the parade, because there's a good chance that there isn't another one in their lifetimes.
Yeah, well, we will watch it. But let's switch to politics and economics, because I certainly know far too little about sports and hockey to say anything intelligent. But before I do that, I just want to thank again another terrific group of Hub Fellows who've joined us this past week. These are individuals making a one-time $500 contribution to support the work of the Hub, getting all the benefits of subscription forever as long as we're publishing. They are part of our valued Hub Fellows community. So thank you, Andy C., for your generous donations. There is a Colleen S. Sean, you may want to comment on that Hub Fellow. Eric B. and Leaf M. So thank you all, everybody, for your generous support.
Yes, indeed. And I'll let the cat out of the bag. I think Colleen S. might be my mom.
And so
I'm grateful that she's become a fellow, although I'm going to have to give her a call.
Took her 3 years.
Exactly.
She wanted to make sure this thing wasn't going to crash and burn. So she's got a good chance of getting those lifetime benefits for at least another 12 months, eh? That's
exactly.
Hilarious. Well, look, let's jump into the budget, because it was the big story this week. And I guess I want to frame it to you, Sean, in the context of, you know, a lot of our conversations on this podcast, a lot of the work that we've been doing at The Hub over the last 12 months is trying to bring attention to this concept of a lost decade that Canada has faced. Unfortunately, a combination of factors and forces that have really, at least since the pandemic, raised some concerning numbers about declining per capita GDP, about the lack of new business starts, the increase in business exits, surging public sector payrolls. The picture was grim going into this budget in terms of reversing some of these trends that have brought about the lost decade for Canada. What, if any, substantive, I don't know, accomplishments can you point to in this budget to address, I think, the number one issue facing the country, facing all Canadians? Or, unfortunately, do we just have to concede that this Liberal government at this moment refuses to accept the premise, even, that there is a national emergency, as the Bank of Canada Deputy Governor characterized it just a few weeks ago, to break the proverbial glass and pull the alarm for the 4 or 5 alarm fire?
Yeah, as you say, Rudyard, I think if you had to distill in simple terms what we believe to be the greatest challenge facing the country in the short and over the long term, it is economic stagnation and flatlined or declining labor productivity. You know, I think it was Paul Krugman, incidentally, who said something like, over the long run, productivity is everything. And if you believe that, looking at the position we find ourselves in, you think you would be seized by, you know, trying to put forward policy ideas that would get at that fundamental challenge. And the budget doesn't do that. In fact, what's interesting is if you look at just the construction of the budget, the chapters that comprise the budget, the chapter on economic growth, such as it is, appears fourth. It's after issues like intergenerational fairness, housing, affordability, etc. So this is not a budget that is organized around that principal challenge facing the country. But if I was going to steel man the government side here, I think what I would argue, Rudyard, I think what it would argue is that it has a, to use your word, a theory of the case. And its theory of the case goes something like this, that there isn't a trade-off between economic growth and its social policy objectives. It really believes that its social policy pursuits are themselves growth-enhancing, that issues like childcare and affordable housing and dental care and all of these various policies that really have come to define this government amount to a growth agenda. The challenge, of course, is after almost 9 years, the facts kind of speak for themselves, don't they? That this notion that you could essentially substitute social policy for, you know, the basics of economic policymaking, including tax competitiveness, a stable regulatory agenda, sound money, etc., has proven wrong. And yet the government clearly has not changed course in this week's budget. The extent to which it's has an economic agenda, such as it is, it's mostly on the margins. This budget is shot through with this focus on social policy, which has really animated the government since it was first elected.
Yeah, well said. You know, and I think those of us that really do care, deeply care about the huge opportunity costs we're going to be running for not getting economic growth, you know, back on track, making up for this lost decade in a perverse way. And I know this is a little bit twisted, but I took some satisfaction that by Friday, if you care about these things, and I think people do care about them, you know, the 5-year Canadian bond, so the bond the government issues to borrow money over 5 years, the yield on that bond was up over the course of the week. And I'm not saying that's entirely related to the budget. There's lots of other things going on in the world right now. But my point is, if there's a reason to be optimistic, is I think we're starting to see the limits of this policy, of a relentless focus on redistribution as opposed to wealth creation.
Yes.
And what I mean, Sean, is that Nicholas Neary, you know, our terrific bond market investor and writer at the Hub, you know, pulled out a data point for our roundup on the budget. I urge people to check it out on our website, a roundup of our kind of best economic contributors and their analysis. We're issuing a lot of debt now in Canada in order to fund these perpetual deficits and this massive expansion of government over the last decade. The budget's predicting bonds in 2024-25, 9% from the year before, and it's twice the pre-pandemic pace, twice. The issue is that Canada, you know, again, I just don't think our political class really understand any of this stuff. Like, we don't have a reserve currency. No one has to buy our bonds. No one has to own Canadian dollars. And I think what's starting to happen is we're starting to understand that this profligacy isn't cost-free. In fact, it's going to cost all of us. It's going to show up in higher mortgage costs for you and me, for all of our listeners. It's going to show up in higher personal credit, auto loans. Corporate financing is going to get more expensive because it's simple math. If you're issuing more and more debt in a non-reserve currency, you've got to compensate people for, you know, a couple of risks, the risk of inflation, which is not fully tamed, at least internationally. You got to compensate them for the risk that your currency is going to devalue. Canadian dollar has not had a good 3 months. And you got to compensate them for the risk of your creditworthiness, your ability to make good on your debts. And I think, Sean, I don't know, again, it's a bit perverse here because this is not comfortable for Canada. In fact, it could become quite painful. As I wrote in my contribution to the roundup, I think this is the beginning of Canada entering onto a permanently higher plateau when it comes to borrowing costs, not just for the government, but for all of us, for businesses and for individuals. And I'm hopeful that as the pain of that begins to register through the economy, that this becomes a block, a mechanism to thwart this vision of a perpetually debt and deficit financed, all-encompassing government encroaching not into our lives, but into entire swaths of provincial, you know, jurisdiction. You know, the beast is hungry right now. It's trying really hard to satiate its appetite. But the reality is that it's starting to run up against some hard limits in our capacity to borrow at rates that are in any way economically rational. I mean, I'll turn it over to you, but just this final stat that we dug up this week that, you know, the GST now, which, you know, again, I used to think, oh, well, I'm collecting this GST. It's a real pain in the butt, but maybe it's paying for some hip surgeries or it's sending some kids to university. Maybe the GST is doing something good for all of us. Well, this year, according to the government's own projections, all the GST that all of us are paying and collecting for the government will simply service the interest costs on the debt.
Yeah, that's a ton of insight there, Roger. I don't think the government is out of the woods yet. We haven't had all of the credit rating agencies render judgment on this week's budget. I think that will spill into next week. I don't think it's implausible that we see a downgrade. I think the tax increase that the government imposed on capital gains, which I suspect we'll get into in this conversation, may be enough on the revenue side to satisfy those credit rating agencies that the government isn't just using its credit card to run up spending. But I think it's totally an open question. And as for your point about both the direct and indirect costs associated with this run up in deficits and debt, which of course continues in this budget, there is no future projection towards a balanced budget over the planning period. That will mean that the Trudeau government will have run, will have overseen deficits starting in 2015 out through 2030. You'll remember that it wasn't that long ago, of course, Rudyard, that Canadians took a great pride that we had a federal government in the black, and we contrasted that with the profligacy that we were seeing in the United States and elsewhere. That's obviously out the window. But just on the, you mentioned the debt service costs, I do think it is worth drilling down into that for a minute. Listeners will know, of course, that the government has to pay interest costs on the debt that it's accumulated, kind of like the way we pay interest on our credit cards. That debt cost for the Canadian government when Prime Minister Trudeau is first elected is about $20 billion, Rudyard. So, you know, not an insignificant amount of money, but in relative terms, it was. This year, it's projected to be almost $55 billion. So just in 9 years, the debt cost means that those dollars aren't going to things that Canadians care about, like national defense or national security or transfers to provinces or whatever. That's an incremental $35 billion that now is just going to paying off the debt that's accumulated over the past 9 years. And that number itself is to rise to something approaching $70 billion by the end of the decade, assuming that borrowing remains as projected. So that's a very long way of saying you're right to emphasize both the direct costs associated with this run-up in deficits and debt, but there are these opportunity costs that sometimes can be overseen, but they're significant. You know, just to emphasize this point, we've seen estimates that in order to get Canada to the NATO target of 2% of GDP would involve incremental spending of something approaching $20 billion a year. Well, that's less than half of what we're presently spending just on servicing our debt. There are costs and consequences to this debt deficit and debt accumulation that we've seen over the past 9 years. And as you say, hopefully one of the consequences of those costs increasingly starting to bite is a reminder both to policymakers, but as importantly to Canadians themselves, that there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah. And I think we should just take a run here at this liberal talking point that, well, Canada's debt to GDP ratio in terms of federal debt versus the size of the economy is quite low, and therefore, we shouldn't be concerned about this. Again, another excellent hub economic contributor, Livio Di Matteo, has written for us extensively that, invoking some of his Italian heritage, that, you need to think of Canada as a kind of palazzo of debt. Like, it's not just the debt of the federal government, it's the debt of the provinces. Some of them, Ontario, the largest subnational debt on a per capita basis, really in the developed world. As Trevor Toome has been writing for us, explosion of debt in British Columbia, off the charts. In other words, we're racking up a lot of subnational debt. We've got one of the most indebted consumers in the world, partly because of what's happened in our housing sector. So you put that all together, Sean, and if you look at Canada's debt to GDP ratio, not in terms of just the federal government, but individuals, corporations, non-financial corporations, government debt, you add that all up, our debt to GDP ratio is ahead of Greece and behind Japan. Okay? Like, that's not good company to be keeping. And again, that, the Ottawa spin point will be, well, it's the federal government that has to borrow. Well, yes, but again, it's borrowing in a non-reserve currency. It's got structural deficits for as long as the eye can see. Their own growth projections within this budget are under 2% per year. 1% of that growth is going to come through immigration. So we're effectively, the economy is sclerotic. It's not growing. It's growing at 1% or less in terms of real economic growth, unaided by immigration. So what happens, and people, again, I just don't think the political class understands this, is that government debt is considered the safest debt. It is, in a sense, the benchmark that all other debt is priced off. And other debt is considered more risky because it isn't backed by the full faith and credit of the sovereign. So corporate debt is going to cost more than government debt. Personal debt is going to cost more than corporate debt, and so on and so on and so on. This is important because if we are entering into a plateau of higher permanent federal borrowing costs, which this government does nothing to address in this budget because it perpetuates large-scale deficit spending forever, all of us will pay more. All of us will lose more of our incomes to our own debt servicing, just in the same way that the government is losing its revenues to its debt servicing. So again, I just say, like, this stuff is real, people. It's not abstract. It's not like, oh, I'm not going to be around when this money has to be repaid back, or, oh, these are all just great investments. Let's see what happens. Well, let's put a couple billion into AI and just like hope for the best. This is going to show up in your mortgage payment for years to come, in your car loans, on your credit card. You are a silent partner, an unwilling silent partner in the profligacy and the fiscal irresponsibility of this government.
Yeah, well said. I think it is worth pulling back for a minute. We've talked about the outcomes of the government spending choices, which are these deficits and the debt accumulation that we've seen, not just in this budget, but really since the government was first elected. But it's worth asking ourselves, what has driven those deficits and debt? Now, I think we can set aside the pandemic in a way. People can debate whether the government's response to the pandemic was too profligate, was too costly. But I don't think anyone disputes that the government was going to go in the deficit in part because revenues dropped like a rock during the pandemic, and because there clearly was a need to support individuals and businesses through the government-imposed lockdowns. But focusing on the pandemic in any case misses the point, that the government has, since it was first elected, increased spending outside of the pandemic by an average of about 7% per year. That's in fact how much the budget's projected to grow this year in 22 2024-25. And it prompts the question, well, what have we gotten for all of that incremental spending? The budget has gone from about $250 billion in the last year of the Harper government to now something approaching $480 billion in this fiscal year. So not quite a doubling, but getting pretty darn close in terms of program spending. And what makes the deficits in debt so objectionable, Rudyard, is that that it hasn't gone to long-term investments. You know, we don't have a bunch of new infrastructure across the country. We haven't fundamentally strengthened the country's defense capacity in terms of acquiring a bunch of new military and defense assets. We haven't seen, you know, the type of expansion of public institutions that we saw in the 1960s and 70s, when we basically deficit financed the creation of the modern post-secondary ecosystem across the country. This has been basically short-term consumption on the government credit card, and that continues in this year's budget. You know, one may agree or disagree with some of the individual measures in the budget. I happen to like some of them. But the question shouldn't be, do you like them if they can be deficit financed? If we really like them, if the government wants to make the case to Canadians that these measures are important for the country, that they represent a justified use of the state and of public resources, then they ought to make the case that they're paid for in year with taxpayer resources, that they aren't deficit financed. And of course, in an era of low borrowing costs, as we've seen over the better part of the past decade or two, the government hasn't been confronted with that choice. It's gone about basically growing the size of government by stealth. In fact, it is now 2 or 3 percentage points higher as a share of GDP than it was when the Trudeau government was first elected. But I do think we really need to start to have a conversation about what we think government should do, what we don't think government should do, and how much are we prepared to pay for it? Because, as you say, government on the credit card, government on the cheap, it can't go on forever. It's ultimately unsustainable.
Yeah, empty calories that we're consuming, you know, spent on or accumulated through, you know, the sweat equity of Canadians. It's not a good deal. Sean, let's take a quick break. I want to come back on the other side and talk about, you know, the capital gains, the change in this capital gains inclusion, because promise people we're not going to kind of wig out as tax accountants, because neither of us are, but this is important. It sends an important signal about the Canadian economy, about its future, and it's eliciting quite a backlash since the budget was announced on Tuesday. So we're going to bring you that cap gains debate right after this break. Do you have a public policy idea to help solve Canada's shelter and housing affordability crisis? If you do, be sure to check out the Hunter Prize at www.thehub.ca. The Hunter Foundation is offering up to $50,000 in prize money for the best low-cost, high-impact policy idea to make housing and shelter more affordable. Weigh in now with your thoughts, your big thinking on this important public policy challenge, www.thehub.ca. Welcome back to the Hub Roundtable. Rudyard Griffiths here, the publisher of The Hub. I'm joined by Sean Spear, our editor at large. So, Sean, if there was one thing that came out of the budget that seems to have elicited the greatest kind of amount of commentary and debate, and we've had it in the pages of The Hub, which has been terrific, it's the decision to increase the inclusion rate on capital gains from 50% taxation to 75%. There's an annual $250,000 exemption at the lower 50% rate for individuals, but the higher rate will immediately kick in for all corporations and trusts. Sean, give us a sense of the debate we had in the Hub this week, because I think there's an important kind of, I certainly appreciated it, because it clarified that there are some legitimate policy reasons to think that a higher inclusion rate on capital gains, you know, from a policy perspective could make sense. But the economics of this, the real world impacts on the economy, on investing, on startups. And there's also, I think, some very strong arguments that this is going to be potentially very detrimental to the Canadian economy in the years to come.
Yeah, we were grateful to have both Trevor Toome, who regularly writes for us on economics, take up this issue, and Derek Hunter, who is a Calgary-based investor and had a slightly different perspective than Trevor. And let me try to reconcile the two. Trevor, you know, who I happen to think is one of the best economists in the country, looked at the tax change through the lens of tax policy principles and makes the case that there is a conceptual argument that the tax change is justified on the grounds that that tax policy shouldn't preference one source of income versus another. I think it is important to emphasize, though, and this might have been lost in some of the reading of Trevor's analysis, is that Trevor is not arguing for a net increase in the government's tax take, which of course is what the government has done here. It has raised this tax in and of itself, and it's, you know, using the revenues for whatever purpose. In Trevor's mind, if you were going to make this change as a matter of tax policy principle, it should have been used to offset taxes in other areas, including, for instance, reducing the top marginal rate for high income earners. Derek's argument is that in response is that, notwithstanding Trevor's conceptual arguments in favor of kind of consistency across the tax treatment of different sources of income, that taxes on capital amount to just about the most economically damaging forms of taxation that one could think of, which is also a pretty well-established both matter of concept and empirics when it comes to tax policy. It's a reason, of course, that economists tend to preference consumption taxes, because the economic costs associated with taxing consumption is much lower than taxing capital. I won't go on and on about the kind of wonky debate about tax policy, but I think it is worth just emphasizing one point, Rudyard, that if you start from the premise, which we did at the outset, that the biggest challenge facing the country is economic stagnation, low business investment, and accompanying low productivity, it does seem like an odd time, particularly in a moment when the government is trying through a whole bunch of different levers to increase investment in market-based housing supply to wallop entrepreneurs and investors with what amounts to a pretty significant tax increase, $20 billion over the next 5 years, $7 billion this year alone, which amounts to the equivalent of a percentage point increase in the GST. There is a kind of inherent dissonance between the tax increase as set out in the budget and the kind of economic conditions in which this budget was ultimately made.
Yeah, and I think what I urge people to read Derek Hunter's piece on the site, because I think it makes just a critical point that, you know, there's a difference between payroll income and income accrued through capital gains. You know, one's about risk-taking. One's about often having to be, you know, patient and allowing potentially years to pass before you accrue the capital gains that you would hope for when you made the investment. And there's also this horrible thing out there called inflation that eats away at your return while you're waiting for your capital gain. So, you know, as Derek points out, and I think it's bang on, like, you tax what you want less of. You know, you tax cigarettes so people smoke less. You put sin tax on booze so people drink less. You put tax on capital gains, you're going to get less of them. it's kind of common sense, right? And I think, Sean, there's just something here that is, again, something we talked about on this show a lot, that what this country needs is a reawakening of the animal spirits, to quote, you know, Schiller, the economist. We have to get people, like, hungry again, excited about, like, striving and thriving together. And the profit motive is this beautiful thing. Like, it's this beautiful thing that gets us all off the couch, fired up, ready to go, because there's a sense that we can materially improve our lives through risk taking and work and commitment and perseverance. And I worry about how these policies, that people don't understand the the kind of psychological effects that they have, this just further dampens, in my view, the very animal spirits that, you know, our country so urgently needs at this moment.
I think that's right. And I would just add to that point, Roger, that when capital walks away, it's usually not a single, there's usually not a single cause, right? It's sort of built up over time. And by the time you realize it, it's almost too late. And, you know, one thing that we hear a lot through members of the Hub community and our other conversations with members of the investor and business community across the country is that capital just feels increasingly under siege at the national level and across the provinces. And so, you know, in and of itself, is this policy going to have huge effects? It's hard to know. The empirical evidence is pretty clear, as you say, that higher taxes on capital will have some effect on investment flows in the country. That's pretty clear. But I think the bigger risk almost is that this is almost a straw that breaks the camel's back in a way, that that it reflects a kind of the cumulative burden and the kind of cumulative hostility that we've seen or aversion that we've seen out of policymakers towards capital and business over, you know, the better part of a decade. And I worry a bit, Roger, that in that sense, the government is kind of underestimating the effects of this, that looking at it through kind of conceptual or technocratic lens may cause them to miss this sort of almost psychological effect that this measure on top of so many others
bang on
has.
It's bang on. You're, you know, and I mean, just look at it. It almost, from an after-tax perspective to the individuals, it almost makes dividend income, you know, very close to capital gains income, you know, coming through as it's treated within a corporation. And, you know, it's interesting, like, you don't want that scenario. I mean, dividend investing is something very different. These are all those companies that we know in Canada that are cash flow companies that often have, you know, the ability through regulation and, you know, duopolies, oligopolies to have what are called moats around them to allow the return of cash back to investors through dividends. And it's a very different kind of economy. And I think we all agree that there's a place for that type of investing and those types of companies in our economy. But what we also need are, you know, the risk takers, the people that are going to say, you know what, here's a startup. I have no idea. It's high risk. They go bankrupt all the time. Yeah, but I'm gonna take this risk because I have some confidence in management and their business idea because there's a reward for the risk. So if you're mismatching risk and reward, you're gonna end up with an economy that has an inherent conservatism to it, that in a bad way, that starts to allocate capital to quote safe investments that, you know, because of tax treatment, really there's no incentive to make the riskier bet. And if you look at job creation and you look at the situation we've documented in the Hub extensively over the last few weeks about how new business starts have fallen to like decades record lows, new business exits are up significantly. Like, this is the very moment we should have been going in the opposite direction to try to actually reflect what we're seeing out the proverbial windshield of the economy.
Yeah.
So I worry about this budget. It's like a renunciation, a denial of reality. And that spooks me because it feels like there's so many just demonstrable empirical signs that we should be paying attention to, that this is a very high stakes moment for Canada. And then we have a couple of years, you know, to start turning this around, or another lost decade will be upon us, will be the legacy of these budgets and of public policy that we're enduring right now. So explain to me, Sean, why this like ability to just deny reality, tune out what are just hard empirical facts that suggest that unless you address these issues, new business starts, injecting more capital. Foreign direct investment has fallen off a cliff in Canada. Like, how can they ignore all this? Like, how is that possible?
I think a big part of it is ideology. And that may surprise some of our listeners, particularly some of our older listeners who grew up in an era when the Liberal Party of Canada was the centrist, pragmatic party in our political system that, while it had a social conscience, was also had good relationships on Bay Street, kind of instinctively understood the benefits of a growing economy. It's not lost on me, for instance, Rudyard, that this capital gains tax change reverses a change that was enacted in 2000 by Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin. I mean, in a way, that symbolizes this transformation of the Liberal Party. And what's interesting is you saw almost like a... What do they call it, Rudyard, when a dictator is kicked out of his country and he's held somewhere else?
Like a French villa on the French Riviera. Yeah, there's a lot of African dictators that end up in Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat or...
I kind of felt like that was Bill Morneau this week, right? Like saying, what's happened to my party? This specific proposal, he said, came across his desk over successive budgets as the former finance minister by the kind of pointy heads in the Department of Finance. And he rejected it on the grounds that the economic costs would be too high. And I think there's something kind of telling that Morneau is now on the outside looking in, and Chrystia Freeland, who I think does sort of personify in a way this ideological transformation of the Liberal Party, is the one that ultimately enacted this change. I think there's a whole generation of older Canadians who are having to kind of confront the fact that the party that they understood to be this party ultimately shot through with pragmatism is now actually quite a dogmatic party, quite a kind of dogmatically left-wing party. And I think that's ultimately why it doesn't see the kind of facts and reality that you're talking about.
Yeah, let's remember the Prime Minister's, attack line in Parliament after the budget was to goad Pierre Poilievre that he was, defending the, quote, ultra rich. I mean, this kind of class warfare language is like something you expect out of like a hard left labor, UK labor type party and leader. And it just shows to me like how far we have come. We now have a Liberal Party of Canada that is effectively vilifying wealth creation. I don't know, Sean, you hope this is kind of where the pendulum starts to swing the other way. Like this is the nadir of Liberal Party politics and the surge to the left. But boy, this Liberal Party is unrecognizable. I mean, it is unrecognizable from even a decade ago. Sean, look, we've covered the budget. We looked at it from 30,000 feet. We got a little bit wonked out on on capital gains inclusion rates, but it is important to like it's kind of the psychological effects, what this really says about the country, what the government is saying about wealth creation, the vilification of trying to strive and thrive together. Again, I go back to that. Like we need some animal spirits, and this budget was a big wet blanket. Sean, be well. Fingers crossed for the Leafs. Join you. I know you're a hardcore fan, so you'll hopefully let me tag along as a Johnny Come Lately to the Leafs fan club. Okay, buddy, be good. Thank you for listening to the Hub Roundtable. If you're looking for great daily analysis and insights on the issues driving the public conversation, check out thehub.ca. Our website gives you access to all the Hub's original news reporting and the thinking of our best writers, including Sean Spear and yours truly, Rudyard Griffiths. While you're on thehub.ca, consider clicking the join button. This will take you to the Hub's complimentary membership offer. Put in your email and you'll receive each Saturday a compilation of the Hub's best writing and commentary from the week that was. The Hub Roundtable is produced and edited by Amal Atter-Guzman. Thank you for listening.